Before rock and roll, before pop, before everything, there was the blues, the music of struggle, triumph, and truth. Welcome to Talking Blues, where we honor the legends and tell the stories that shape modern music. Here's your host, Matt Cooper.
The West Coast blues scene was in its infancy in 1935 when T-Bone Walker arrived in Los Angeles. You know, at that time, blues hadn't really taken deep root in California. But T-Bone brought something new, a Texas-style sound, refined, electrified, and deeply musical. He played with jazz bands, cleaned up the phrasing, helped shape a version of the blues that would become smoother, sharper, more urban, but still emotionally raw. Then World War II changed everything. The California shipyards called for skilled workers en masse. African-American families came west by the thousands, bringing their culture, their food, and most importantly, their music. That's when the West Coast blues scene really began to grow. Cities like Oakland, Richmond, L.A., filled with players and listeners, hungry for something familiar, but evolving. The blues took on a new flavor. Still Southern at its core, but shaped by the coast. My guest today comes straight out of that lineage. Ira Walker is a Grammy-nominated producer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, and soul singer. He co-wrote I Want to Go Back for Eddie Money, toured with Keb Moe, shared the stage with Carlos Santana and B.B. King. He's produced 14 albums, released standout records like Blame Me and That Be That Man, and now calls Ontario home. He carries the West Coast tradition in every nerdy place, and we're lucky to have him with us. Let's get into it right now with the great Ira Walker.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for having me, man. I appreciate the warm introduction. My mother would have been proud of you.
Growing up in the Bay Area in the 60s, your ears had options. You know, if you were twisting the dial, you might have landed on KDIA out of Oakland, soul, blues, gospel. That's where a lot of folks heard B.B. King for the first time. But then you had KSAN or KMPX on the FM side, underground stuff, mixing Money with Hendrix and Taj with Tower of Power. Tell us about what station you were glued to in those days and what you remember hearing back when, you know, when it kind of lit the fuse for you.
You know, you kind of startled me with your expertise. You're spot on. All the stations you just named, absolutely. KSAN, Dusty Road, the famous DJ there. It was great to meet him. And then KDIA, you know, it's interesting. I was lucky enough to come from an era where African-American music was really growing. You had James Brown, Aretha Franklin, Otis Redding, Joe Tex, The Temptations, The Jackson 5. And so you had this incredible influx of music. I think the thing that's kind of unspoken of, especially in my community, is there's no genres. So people say, oh, it sounds like this or it sounds like this. In the church, you pick up the instrument, and when a guy starts playing, you just join in, you know, AKA the band, Bob Dylan, The Grateful Dead. And I think that's one of the things that makes the Grateful Dead and bands like Fish so appealing. There's the combination of the drone and the things that get you rolling. That's right out of the church. That's right out of Celtic music. So the similarities are really rooted in something very primitive. But in the Bay Area, we had such a wide array of stations and musicians. You know, my wife, who I met in California, would listen to music from Oakland, come back to Hamilton for the summer to do summer camp and stuff, and she's talking about songs and things that people haven't even heard of. The network and the fluidity of communication these days is a totally different beast. I mean, I remember very young when we had a party line, you know, you had to wait for the other person to get off the phone. When Elvis was becoming famous, he was only famous in one particular region, you know, and record promoters didn't have emails, they had cars. So the Bay Area, I was really lucky to have a leg up on all of that. Once I met Eddie Money, that really changed my career. But there was a few musicians in my neighborhood, like Larry Band. He was the band leader for the Whispers, the original Whispers. And I would sell kids permission to sit on my lawn. My mom would make lemonade, and we'd watch the Whispers rehearse across the street. And of course, I would get drum lessons from him. His parents were so nice that, I don't know how old am I, 11, 12. He'd be on the road for a couple of weeks, and I'd ride around to his house, and his dad said, hey, go on in the house. I know what you want. And as soon as I walk in the door, his mom would go, ooh, how you doing, baby? Let me make you a sandwich. Go on in there and play them drums as long as you want. His mom, his parents, they would let me go into his room and play his drum. I had no intentions of ever buying a drum set. And me becoming a songwriter is all by happenstance. I like music. I didn't really see me becoming a professional musician. I had desires on academia. But my first concert was Jimi Hendrix. And it wasn't the music. It wasn't his clothes. I grew up doing oratorical competitions. My mother was an English major. My father spoke Latin. And he was a glorified gardener. But it was his gut-wrenching that everything he sang, every word he sang, every note he played, it was with such intensity and style. And I remember I had a cousin who was the lead singer in a band called the Cobras. That was Jimmy Vaughn's first band when he was like 16, 17, out of Texas. And his brother was coming to the Bay Area to play for the first time. So myself and some friends went to see Stevie. And that was the next time I saw that intensity. Now, it's kind of strange. Now, the best concert I ever went to, working backwards, Bruce Springsteen, The Grateful Dead, 4, Bruce Springsteen, 3, Paul McCartney and Wings, 2, and Cat Stevens, 1. So in the Bay Area, you have a real expansive opportunities. I would say that is the pinnacle of the music industry around the world. More rock stars came out of that one 300, 400 mile radius. But yeah, growing up, I liked playing the blues because my dad was a big blues fan. So even doing these oratorical competitions, I was bored to tears, but my mother liked it, and she gave me ice cream. Fuck it. Where's the downside? You know, guys said to me, hey, man, you know, how do you handle fame? I go, man, I've been famous for so long. I said, hey, let me tell you about my first bout with fame. He goes, when was that? Was that when you got your first record deal, like on Capitol? Was that when you did your first gig at the Oakland Coliseum in front of 50,000 people with Eddie? I said, nope. My first bout with fame was the blind kids lining up to get a ride on my mini bike. I was the coolest kid. I was the most likable person I could ever be. So that was my first bout with fame. And my dad worked at the California School for the Deaf and Blind, and that was a life-changing experience. It calmed my juvenile senses at an early age. So I like music. At one point, I was taking drum lessons. I'd see David Garibaldi. I'd come out of my lesson. He'd come into his lesson. My drum lesson, I'm taking upright bass lessons, which I didn't want to do, but I was forced into it because I was expecting to take electric. And a guy was hell-bent on me playing upright and learning how to read, which was a game changer for my whole life. And then I went to the music store and had a new guy. He was a Spanish guy. And he had the pompadour and the cool clothes and shoes and Latin jazz. I mean, in my black neighborhood, there was no Latin jazz. But I just loved the way that sound sounded. So that got me into West Montgomery. It really got me into T-Bone Walker because he played the same style of guitar. So, but never thought I was going to be a songwriter until I got the gig with Eddie. And I realized that my ability to be interpretive was unique. There's people that I look up to, like, you know, Chet Atkins, Carol Kay, James Jameson, you know, Skunk Baxter, Danny Kuchmar. Danny Kuchmar discovered James Taylor, produced all of them, James Taylor, Jackson Browne, Linda Ronstadt. He's that cat. The Eagles, they all know Danny Kuchmar. And these are guys like Carol Kay who are just behind the scenes, James Jameson, but they just killing it. So I never, it wasn't, a lot of that stuff is so subjective. I was just fortunate enough to get hired and, you know, to make a bit of a living. And Eddie introduced me to Roy Siegel when I first went to Fantasy with Eddie. Bill Graham was in discussion. He was having a hard time. They wouldn't partner up with him at Columbia. Finally, he got Wolfgang Records. That was Bill Graham's real name. And his first artist he signed was Eddie. I like Bill Graham. He was a real cool dude, you know. When you're African American, you know, it's an interesting dichotomy. First of all, you better watch yourself, but everybody better watch themselves. Wherever you go, somebody gonna tell you what to do. So if you got a crappy attitude, no matter what ethnic origin you are, you know, police, doctors, teachers, public officials, but it is sort of the oppressed see the oppressor in ways the oppressor can't imagine. So the African-American musical experience is definitely one from the inside out. Yeah, I mean, there's some really great musicians and who have gravitated to the essence of that cultural phenomenon. But just imagine if the black soldiers don't go to World War I, and if they're not teaching African Americans to read classical music in New Orleans. That's the lineage of jazz. So these people who would learn how to read went back to the community, and people were popping their heads out of the ground like a bunch of meerkats trying to learn it.
There's a lot to unpack there. If I could just jump in. First, the blues conditions generating the blues emotions, which leads to a blues expression. And that's some of the wonderful material that's come along. Perhaps your exposure to very upwardly mobile and erudite parents, your father being an orator, your mother being an English professional, perhaps that led to your ability as a songwriter. You know, you had a very strong background there.
Yeah, I was able to embrace a broader spectrum of understanding. So even though I like classical music and having a degree in classical percussions, that was what drew me to music, was classical music. And I'm in discussion with my parents because of the proximity to UC Berkeley. I was very fortunate that I was the only guy in my neighborhood who had these sort of opportunities. Like I said, my father, with his degree in horticulture, it was weird. The downside was is the other kids would tease you because your dad would hug the trees in the neighborhood and talk to the plants. That's a crazy shit right there. But, you know, I was sort of a free thinker like they were. And my father liked the blues, so we heard the blues on Saturday. And my mother was into more gospel music, so a lot of Mahalia Jackson. I can't think of some of the other groups that she would play all the time. Of course, Sam Cooke, he had a gospel record, and he had a group that he performed with. I can't remember. But, you know, you sort of listen to all that stuff. I'm playing drums in the church all by happenstance. I would go there on Saturdays. One of my good friends, I would get dropped off there and then go hang out with him, play all day Saturday, get up from his house and go to church. And my parents would pick me up from church on Sunday. But it was three boys and it was four of me with them. And it was always just really great stuff. But he was a child prodigy and he played organ in the church. So waiting for him to get finished, you know, I throw popcorn, potato chips, just stuff that boys do. And one time the choir director called me and says, "Oh, I got your little black ass today, don't I?" And my buddy goes, "He plays drums." And they got this old Slingerland jazz big band kit with the muffle on the outside, big old 28-inch kick drum, boom, boom, boom. Things like a marching drum. Muffle on the thing, a sizzle cymbal. Well, if you hit that thing, it just rings till tomorrow, right? And no hi-hat. But it taught me a lot about rhythms. And so now when I listened, started listening to reggae, it was easy to see that the beat was just turned around, but everything else was the same. So I had this innate thing, and I think a lot of African American musicians have it. It's something you're born with, you know, your ability to file away rhythms and tones, the same way I think in Indian, Middle Eastern Indian music and Chinese, you know, the half tones, quarter tones, it all means something to your ethnic group if you're used to hearing it that way. And, you know, there's a lot of guys, man, they play the blues and bless their heart, but, you know, it's still a second language. And if your grandmama didn't call you the N-word, you can't say it. But if your grandmama said, hey, you little so-and-so, get your so-and-so over here, you can say anything you want to say, do anything you want to do. But it's a nice experience. And a friend of mine who went on to play with Sly Stone and Robin Trower, Rusty Allen, was the guy I looked up to in my neighborhood. So I got lessons from him. I gave lessons to Freddie Washington, who wound up with Patrice Rushen and then the guys who play in Larry Graham's band today, they're all guys, you know, from my neighborhood. I knew Sheila E. Gail Muldrow, Bonnie Boyer. These are all people who played with Prince throughout the years. So from the Bay Area, there's something about that affiliation with Sly Stone. And there's a lot of correlations between Prince and Sly. Multicultural, females, no limitations, all one big happy family. And that work ethic, you know, is, you don't hear that much about it with Sly. But Gail, she was my age, and so we're kind of like little punksketeers trying to emulate Sly, you know. And her mom made the clothes that you see Sly wearing. So she was that chick. It's kind of crazy. So Rusty played with Lil Sister, Jerry Martini, Rose. They had a band that was signed for a while. And I would see Rusty get on the bus with his 212 bassman. And I always had a lot of respect for that. And he gave me a couple of lessons. And I was pretty much ready to go because I like music. So to have the gift to this tribal connection of the African American music interpretation, and then have guys who are teaching you and, you know, encouraging you. So Rusty, who's 3 years older than me, says, hey, I can't make a Johnny Talbert gig. I need you to go fill in for me. And Johnny Talbert is a blues singer, a pimp out of Texas, but a lot of hustlers and nefarious guys. Those port cities, New York, New Orleans, Liverpool, Oakland, San Francisco, Emeryville, and my neighborhood. So I auditioned for Johnny, and he needs a bass player in a hurry, so it's blues. I can play the shit, you know. But he's a hardcore dude. Shit is wow. And you're 15, but my dad liked the blues. So we're playing New Ruthie's Inn in Berkeley, the Orbit Room in Vallejo. Vallejo is a city, you go underneath the Carquinez Bridge there from San Francisco, and that's the Delta. So if you leave San Francisco, you're going to make a turn to go up the Delta in Vallejo. That's where Vallejo is. So you go along the bay and then you make that turn going east. That's right, Vallejo. He'll takes you right down the delta all the way into Sacramento. A Chinese person could get on a ship and never touch ground again and go all the way to not only to Sacramento, but another 200 miles north. Vallejo to Sacramento is east. Sacramento to Mount Shasta is north. They could go all the way there. And the catacombs in Red Bluff is just wow, it's amazing. That was the opium capital of California. But anyway, I got this gig with Johnny playing Neruti's Inn. And my first gig was Bobby Bland. A couple weeks later, it was Muddy Waters. And then a couple weeks later, it was Howling Wolf. But it was cool because my dad was a blues fan. He thought that shit was. But it was, everybody knows the rules, but if you're not trying to act a fool, ain't nobody trying to police you too hard. Sometimes I notice that people who are not of the same ethnic orientation that I am, they get a little tight in the ass about stuff. And so they let me be in the club as long as I didn't leave past the stage. And that was cool with my father because he sat there. But at the time, I'm listening to all these stories. I remember Muddy Waters just having a time of his life because he's just come back from England. The Rolling Stones are making him famous again. And they're all talking about it. Howlin' Wolf was an extremely large guy. So was Bobby Bland. But I remember Luther Allison. So wait, Luther. No, it's not Luther Allison. I forget his name. Really good blues guy at the time. Those guys were all really, really cool. They were, hey, young man, hey. But it's pretty wild because, a lot of women with intentions running around. But it was quite the learning experience. Never thought I was going to be a musician. My first album was Mary Poppins. My first 45 was Respect. And I played that thing over and over again. I got in Louisiana. We're walking down to the local store. They sell car parts, pig feet, 45s, a lot of homemade shit in jars. You could smell the wood from the wintertime as it's marinating in that hot Louisiana sun. Shit. Man, my uncle would pull out some about four or five raccoons he'd already skinned and froze and put on the grill. I know you're hearing me. Rabbit, squirrels. When you're just used to eating and surviving, it's a whole nother thing. But coming full circle on all of that, my intellectual makeup with my free thinking spirit kind of brought me into songwriting. So I can articulate myself, but I know the difference between a Hallmark card. A lot of people got Hallmark lyrics. Bob Dylan don't. And it's a funny thing, anybody can write a song, so you never know. But there's a reason the Clash were good. There's a reason the Rolling Stones are incredible. incredible. There's a reason Keith Richards couldn't get a gig in nobody's band, and he's one of the greatest guitar players ever. Muddy Waters couldn't get a gig today. His guitar player is just horrendous, but he's the best blues singer to ever sing. And, you know, and it's the same with Bob Dylan. You know, all these people, they have really great vocal skills, but something about that phrasing, Kurt Cobain, that phrasing. And I love people like Michael Jackson, and I love people like Prince, but they ain't James Brown.
I was just going to say Rolling Stones, very influential on bringing Howlin' Wolf on the Shindig in 1965. If you've seen the YouTube video, Stones were invited on Shindig, and they said, well, okay, but you got to get Howlin' Wolf on here. And so I believe that was one of his only major television appearances. And if you watch Howlin' Wolf on Shindig, you can see where Mick Jagger's moves came from. A little bit of Howlin' Wolf.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, a little bit of James Brown.
Yo, no, absolutely. And the same with Elvis. He learned how to dress like that because he was watching them cool black dudes show up on the other side of Tupelo.
I was just going to say Elvis would be on Beale Street digging BB's threads, wouldn't he, in terms of, you know, working out his fashion sense.
Oh, yeah. I don't think it's that big of a deal, but, you know, white America has been aware of that for a long time. So is the rest of the world. We'd still be doing polkas and stuff if, you know. And the music is, it's not just from the United States. It's from the culture of these melanated people. And, you know, boom, da, boom, da, 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 boom. A rock and roll beat is a West African Mali beat. And when that got introduced in the late 1940s, it changed everything in the American music scene. And getting back to the American music scene, around the same time, Oakland was the hub of African American music scene because the guy there, he was smart. He owned laundromats. This is before segregation. Black people were totally sufficient. People weren't jumping up and down in my black community for segregation. That was not the battle cry. It was Martin Luther King's battle cry. We didn't need segregation to write the blues, to do jazz. Wasn't going to change nothing. But it was some other fundamental rights that meant more than segregation. But the music is always going to advance itself because the oppressed see the urgency of self-expression. It just, it comes out like that damn hippity hop music. I don't understand a lot of it, but I know it's freewheeling. I thought I was really talented when I thought I had really come a long way when I went to this club and watched this dude DJing one night. And I said to myself, that dude is the Eddie Van, he's the Eddie Van Halen of this DJ thing. So, you know, perspective is everything. But, you know, growing up in the Bay Area, getting the gig with Eddie, doing sessions over at Fantasy Studios. So my friends were like Brad Gillis and Jack from Night Ranger. They were in a funk band called Rubicon with Jerry Martini. When that fell apart, they started Night Ranger. But let me settle myself down because I'm excited in this interview. His name is Roy Hawkins. Roy Hawkins was a premier piano player in Oakland. So what we know today as rockabilly was the Oakland blues sound from 1948. That was, and Roy Hawkins was the guy whose style, that was his style. He interpreted this. He brought it to the forefront. Roy Hawkins gets into a car accident and loses the use of his left arm. Today, it'd be fixable. But in those days, if it was fixable, he didn't have the money to get it fixed. And if he did, nobody would have fixed it for him. Unfortunately. And a friend of mine who lives around the corner in my neighborhood in East Oakland, Brookfield. My dad, the guy across the street, his dad, they're all military police. So before he joins the army, he's playing drums, and Roy Hawkins, who's already lost the use of his arm, comes in and they say, hey, what's wrong? And Roy goes, my wife is leaving me. And he sits and talks and goes, Roy, what did she say? She said, Roy, I love you. You're a good man. But the thrill is gone. And my buddy's dad, who hadn't joined the army yet, he's only 17. He's got his head down and Roy starts writing, the thrill is gone. That night in the club. Now he records it in 1952. His version doesn't sound like BB's version, which is another side note. As a songwriter, I don't write songs for the artist. I write songs that the artist might like, but he got to do what he got to do when he got to do it when he got to do it to make it do what it do. So, with that in mind, B.B. King, one of the greatest accomplishments was not only his version, completely different, but to hear it that way is magical. And to withstand onslaught. The thrill is gone almost ruined his career. Here's these blues purists people. Okay. You know, can you imagine being from Ireland and you got to go to Japan to judge a line dancing competition? I mean, it's like, yeah, it looks the same. And so he's almost ostracized because he put an electric piano and strings. Now today, when you listen to it, it's just beautiful. But another thing that people don't understand is that Ray Charles had already broken those boundaries. So B.B. King had somebody to lift his awareness and his musical adventurous nature. And Ray Charles had Sam Cooke. They all rose on the backs of some of other artists. And I tell you, here's another secret. James Brown was a child prodigy on the Hammond B3 organ. James Brown played organ in the church as a kid. And he is Muddy and James have the two most dynamic voices, cannot be duplicated. But I appreciate you listening to my music because I can tell you I'm just doing tribal music. So when you notice that it has that quality to it, yeah, that's because I'm doing tribal music. I didn't learn this by listening to Eric Clapton, John Mayall records. No. I heard Jimmy Reed over and over again. Kenny Neal's dad, Rayford Neal, Joe Tex. Yeah. Joe Tex and James Brown in a battle over a woman. That's stuff. So my music and being a songwriter, I don't have really a dog in the race. So when I write, I just write for what I think it should be. And it's like when I see the Last Waltz from the band, that reminded me of my childhood experience. Guys are just diddling around. All of a sudden, Neil Young is coming to the mic. By the time he gets there, everybody is turned around, on point, all in lockstep. And that spirit of that is really what makes music special to me. You know, I watch these guys, they have books on how to write music. And then I listen to this interview with Paul McCartney and said, hey man, how do you write a song? You're such a great songwriter. He goes, what? He says, how do you write a song? He goes, I don't know. But you're a great songwriter. He goes, what's that got to do with it? I have no idea. When it happens, I put the idea down. When it comes to me, I let it flow through me. Next thing you know, I come out into this other reality and everybody goes, hey, I like it. And then I listen back to it and I go, hey, I like it too. But I haven't, I've never had a fault.
Definitely one of my favorites. Hey, tell me about your experience with Paul McCartney and Wings. Was it the Wings Over America tour? Where did you catch that performance?
Well, it's interesting. One of my best friends was Herbie Herbert. Herbie managed Santana Journey. And so I would go to all, I'd go and hang out with Herbie. His wife told me later on that, hey man, he doesn't have very many people come over here. You're one of them. I didn't realize, because I've always been sort of self-effacing, you know. Never that, you know, I've had confidence, but never kind of that full of myself. So for example, I don't need to win a Grammy to feel like I'm a Grammy award-winning songwriter because it's so subjective. But my confidence about what I do is through the roof. But am I better than anybody else? I don't know. I don't know. I know that when I was talking to Booker T, I was producing Laura Satterfield, Booker T's stepdaughter, Rita Coolidge, Laura Satterfield and Priscilla Satterfield had an Indian vocal group because they're all Cherokee Indian descent. But anyway, I said, Booker, I love that what you did with Bill Withers. And he goes, Ira, that record almost didn't come out. I go, why? He says, because Bill Withers was so insecure, he didn't think it was good enough.
Is that the Just Me record?
Ain't No Sunshine, all that stuff. Use Me When You Use Me Up. I don't know what. I don't know. I don't know album. I just know song. And what was the question you asked me before that?
Well, we were talking about our love for Paul McCartney, his influence from James Jamerson.
Oh, so Herbie. So I met. Because Herbie had a company called Nocturne. And Herbie everybody Herbie ever worked with was rich and wealthy. He was a genius, but he had a really pure heart and a fabulous soul. And so people would come to him with ideas, and he jumped on board to the LED video big screen. So he was one of the first producers of the big screen. First thing they started doing was putting them in stadiums. But along the way, to promote it, they were doing concerts. But he was cutting edge on the whole time. And you got to realize at this point, computers are progressing really fast. So today you can have an LED light bulb. All you got to do is just screw it into the socket. There it is. But in the old days, you had to run wire and you had to have a transformer. So Herbie was on the cutting edge of those big screen concert things. And because he was such a cool dude, I got to meet everybody because he and I were friends. So I would hang out with Herbie, Steve Parrish from the Grateful Dead. Steve was Jerry Garcia's guitar tech forever. Bunch of dudes, we like to smoke weed, man, and it was all cool. And I have to say, kind of braggadocious, everybody need to have a cool black friend. Why not me? Shit.
That's a wrap on Talking Blues. If the blues speaks to you, hit subscribe, share the show, and let's keep the tradition alive. Until next time, keep it raw, keep it real.